Blog Talk Radio.
Reduced emissions from deforestation and forest degradation.
In this carbon tax program, Norway would send anywhere from $250 million to $500 million from Norwegian taxpayers to a government of Guyana in South America in order to promote rainforest conservation programs. The money would be collected by the World Bank, then siphoned through the Inter-American Bank of Development to eventually reach the government of Guyana. This is amazing. However, instead of using the money to save trees of the Amazon rainforest, the Guyana government and the Inter-American Bank of Development decided to use the carbon tax money to buy a hydroelectric dam called the Amelia Falls Project. Upon receiving the money, the Guyanan government granted a contract to a company called Synergy Holdings, Inc., headed by a shady character by the name of Makishwar Motilal, a.k.a. Fip or Flip. And not too long after that, the local Guyana media accused Motilal of being a fraud. They also found out that the office of the Synergy Holdings was an abandoned old house. Fip began to take money from the cookie jar and failed to report where he was spending it. $5 million of contract money disappeared. Scandal in Guyana began. The Norwegian Progress Party, which was against this project from the beginning, began to mobilize to stop all funding for it. They wrote an open letter criticizing the project and the Labour Party, and the fact that they are denouncing this carbon tax scam for what it really is has helped them gain political power. The Guyana government backpedaled and announced that they gave the contract to another company called Scythe Global, which is owned by the Rothschild family-controlled Blackstone Group. FIP's contract was downgraded to only build the roads leading to the dam. However, the Norwegian Progress Party still wasn't convinced. Then later, under mysterious circumstances, FIP Motilal attempted to commit suicide in Palm Beach, Florida, on July of 2010. He was taken to a mental hospital clinic for psychological treatment. A few months later, he went back to Guyana, and his vehicle flipped and went over a 40-foot cliff, but yet he survived. Talk about a cockroach that won't die. Overall, the carbon tax pilot program was a failure and a major embarrassment for the Norwegian government and the international banks and the government contractors involved in that scam. Forget the money. They have all the money in the world. This was supposed to be their pilot program, and it failed. As a result, the People Progress Party became a number one obstacle for the carbon tax promoters. The EU policy, the EU police rather, or Europol, began to label them as terrorists. Their Facebook page was hacked earlier this month. Then suddenly, last Friday, a terrorist who happens to be a Progress Party supporter by the name of Anders Breivik bombs the government building and kills a bunch of socialist kids in an island. The news media outlets worldwide have been unleashed, and they are accusing those who support the Progress Party of being extremist, racist, Islamophobes, and even terrorists. Under the media propaganda as a tool, these terror attacks have effectively neutralized the Progress Party and their supporters, and those who deny climate change, those who oppose illegal immigration, higher taxes, and the outsourcing of jobs. In the eyes of the world, these people are now terrorists for agreeing with Anders Breivik. So now they won't have any political leverage to oppose the carbon tax programs. So it's like, you know, this is what they were doing. You know, we gotta look at this stuff. It's fascinating. And you can check this out on Deadline Live with Jack Blood. Fascinating article, I thought. And here's another one on this guy. Gunmen conspired with business and political leaders before the massacre. Now, Anders Behring Breivik said he conspired with business and political leaders in London years before he set about planning last year's massacre. An intriguing connection given the fact that the Gunmen's Manifesto was datelined London 2011, suggesting a clear connection to the capital as evidence emerged of a wider plot. Now, this is right on his own website. I mean, he wrote this manifesto in London, 2011. In the manuscript, Breivik describes his mentor as an Englishman he identifies as Richard, and says his journey into violent extremism began as a small meeting in London in 2002, where a group of like-minded extremists met to reform the Knights Templar in Europe, a military group whose purpose was to seize political and military control of Western European countries and implement a cultural conservative political agenda, reports The Guardian. This is fascinating. In his manifesto to Breivik, said the gathering in London was not a stereotypical right-wing meeting full of underprivileged racist skinheads with a short temper. Instead, he claimed, those present were successful entrepreneurs, business or political leaders, some with families, most Christian conservatives, but also some agnostics and even atheists. The gunman said that the participants of the meeting came from all over Europe, and that he was first put into contact with them by a Serbian crusader commander. Breivik's connection with London, he lived there as a child when his father was working at the Norwegian embassy, are clearly a cornerstone of his plot. Indeed, as Mark Stern writes for the National Review Online, the gunman's manifesto is largely concerned with Britain and America. The entire government, or the entire document, is strangely Anglo-centric, and among the citations of NR and then National Review, Washington Times, there's not a lot about Norway. The manifesto signed by the killer as Andrew Berwick, an anglicized version of his name, is datelined London 2011, clearly indicating Breivik was in the English capital before his rampage. Although the media have asserted otherwise without explaining why Breivik would deliberately place such an error in his own screed. It is now being reported that Breivik was in London as recently as last year, when he took part in an English Defense League march. The EDL is a far-right group that largely comprises of former football hooligans. Its organization is shabby, and the group has attracted an odious reputation of being run by violent, drunk, and racist thugs. The group's unpopularity is habitually exploited by the British establishment to demonize legitimate criticism of mass immigration policies as extremist and racist. The group is routinely labeled neo-Nazi, but the mainstream media yet is staunchly pro-Israel and has displayed Israeli flags at its protests. The EDL routinely clashes with pro-Muslim groups, scenes that are given generous press coverage in order to push clash of civilization rhetoric and keep the British people at each other's throats, enabling the government to engage in divide and conquer tactics by manipulating the public's perception of both groups. Sounds like what's happening with the Democrats and Republicans, ain't it? And since the EDL is mostly made up of gangs of football hooligans, which have been completely infiltrated by British authorities, many have speculated that the English Defense League is being steered and controlled by MI5 with Special Branch. We now know that Norwegian intelligence was aware of Breivik and had included his name on a terrorist watch list back in March. And after the gunman purchased large amounts of fertilizer from an online shop in Poland, this wasn't a sprawling database with hundreds of thousands of names amongst which Breivik could have been lost. It contained just 60 individuals. The list was passed to the police security service by Norwegian Customs, which might explain why police knew Breivik's name before they arrested him. On the island of Utoya, even as the global media was all but concerned, certain that the attacks were the work of Al-Qaeda Muslims, Breivik's financial fortunes certainly took a turn for the better in 2006. According to his tax filings, which are publicly available on the internet for all Norwegian citizens, Breivik has since been deleted by the cash remains. The gunman went from making virtually nothing to an income of over 600,000 krona, roughly $116,000, from between 2006 and 2007. As more details emerge about Breivik's activities, his connections with London, and his assertion that he was merely one of the least three cells, it's obvious that a wider plot involving more people was responsible for last week's carnage. It dovetailed with reports from eyewitnesses who said they heard shots coming from two different parts of the island and saw other gunmen with dark hair. Whether or not an incident that took place in southwest Norway or on Saturday night, in which a man was shot in the head by two men wearing military uniforms, is connected to the attacks remains to be seen. However, Norwegian authorities and the establishment media are actively discouraging the possibility of a wider plot by focusing solely on Breivik and largely disregarding ample evidence of others being involved, thereby ensuring the business and political leaders the gunman said he conspired with remain under the radar. So there we go, folks. And this is from PrisonPlanet.com. You can check this out. Excellent article by Paul Joseph Watson. He always does a good job. Infowars.com, and this one happens to be Prison Planet. Okay. One more. This is one more that I wanted to talk about tonight. How these things just get blown out of hand, and how it's used. It's another one from Infowars. EU exploits Norway massacre to stifle dissent. Wasting little time in exploiting the fresh dead bodies of dozens of Norwegian teenagers to push its draconian agenda, the European Union has swiftly announced that it plans to set up an early warning system to combat extremism, the problem being that EU treats legitimate criticism of its own corrupt institution as extremist. The European Commission is building a security system to issue early warnings on threats of extremism, xenophobia, and other forms of radicalism, EC spokesman Michel Cernan said on Tuesday. EU officials also met on Monday in a bid to curb sales of firearms to law-abiding citizens, despite the fact that it was Norway's policy on not allowing police instant access to firearms that contributed to the scale of last week's attack. Euroscepticism is on the rise across the continent, which is why the neoliberal elite are busy implying that people who oppose being ruled by an unelected, unaccountable Soviet-style bureaucratic tyranny are in league with the Norwegian mass murderer Andrei Breivik. As an example, the fact that Breivik emailed the True Finns party hours before his rampage has somehow been offered as proof that the conservative True Finns bears some of the responsibility for the massacre. This would be like blaming John Lennon and Paul McCartney for the Manson family murders. In reality, EU's crass rush to exploit last week's tragedy has little to do with stopping the new Breivik and a lot to do with the next Breivik, and a lot to do with stifling criticism of its own institution. The EU habitually uses the extremist label to discredit legitimate political opposition to its agenda, particularly when it wants to silence those who speak out against the EU's advocacy of mass immigration policies. In 2009, Dutch Freedom Party MP and prominent Eurosceptic Geert Wilders was refused entry to Britain because his political opinions were deemed offensive under EU law. And, American talk radio show host Michael Savage was banned from entering Britain under the same law in 2009 for making extremist comments that were never even specifically identified by the Labour government. The ban was reaffirmed by the new Conservative-led government 2 months later. British MEP Nigel Farage was also reprimanded by EU Commission heads in 2009 simply for criticizing important EU people. Indeed, under the 1999 ruling of European Court of Justice, it is illegal to criticize the European Union, and the institution is on a mission of marginalize any national political parties that do not pander to the European federal superstate agenda by smearing them as racist and xenophobic. As the European Disunion blog notes, opposition to the expansion of a European federal superstate has been characterized as racism and xenophobia. It is a logical fallacy to suggest that all those who oppose Britain's EU membership are racist or xenophobic. How many times do we have to say it? Getting along with other nations and people does not equate to being ruled by them. And opposing the EU is by definition not racist, for the EU is not a race. It is a political institution. Being racist against the EU is like being racist against NATO or the Scottish National Party. It's impossible. And since EU leaders treat anyone who criticizes the EU itself as racist or extremist and routinely act to silence their free speech, they should be the last people trusted to oversee an early warning system that serves to identify extremist threats. And this is an important article, folks. And this is what's happening here. I mean, we're seeing it now, you know, in this country. We've been seeing it for quite some time. But it's all a directive from there. You know, it starts in Europe and, you know, channels its way over here. So, but we're seeing this. I mean, we're seeing the Tea Party as being extremist. We're seeing the progressive liberals as extremists. We're seeing, you know, anybody who disagrees with the government is an extremist, okay, in the eyes of the government, okay, which is the U.S. government or the EU government. And you just can't do this, man. This is a freedom of speech, and you get the right to dissent. You get the right to talk against your government if they're wrong. Or even if they're right, you still got a right to comment. And that's what this country is based on. If you lose that, which we're quickly losing, you know, we're in big trouble. But anyway, I didn't want to rant. I just wanted to read more articles here because so much of it is... this one is also fascinating. I saw it today. And this is called Investors, the $1 billion Armageddon trade placed against the United States. So they're already speculating about us losing our credit rating. All right, so let's look at this. This is from ETF Daily News, a new source you need, it says. Jack Barnes, someone dropped a bomb on the bond market Thursday. This was July 25th that this was written, and I guess that was last week that it was... that it happened. But someone dropped a bomb on the bond market Thursday, a $1 billion Armageddon trade betting the United States will lose its AAA credit rating. In one moment, an invisible trader placed a single trade that moved the most liquid debt market in the world. The massive trade wasn't placed in bonds themselves, it was placed in the futures market. The trade was for a block trades of 5,370 10-year Treasury futures executed at 124-03 and 3,100 Treasury bond futures executed at 125-01. I'm not certain what that means, but the value of the trade was about $850 million. In simple terms, if that was a direct bond buy, no one would be talking about it. However, with the use of futures, you have to have margin capacity behind the trade. That means with a single push of a button, someone was willing to commit more than $1 billion of real capital to his trade with expectations of a 10-to-1 return ratio. So this guy plans to make $1 trillion on his $850 million bet. Okay, that's who did this? You only do this if you see an edge. This means someone is confident that the United States is either going to default or is going to lose its AAA rating. That someone is willing to bet the proverbial farm that U.S. interest rates will be going up. Now, don't you think that somebody who would do that would want the U.S. to default? Don't you think those bastards are behind the Republican and Democratic stalemate? Okay, they may be on both sides. This means someone is confident the United States is going to lose its rating. I believe what happened is a debt ceiling deal was done in Washington and leaked to a major proprietary trader. Everyone knows the debt negotiations in Washington have been an extreme game of brinksmanship between political parties, but now someone knows how that game played out. This had the hallmarks of one of the largest bond shops in the world knowing something the rest of the market didn't. And don't you know, I'll bet you it was Paul, you know, John Paulson. Paulson or Goldman Sachs or one of these bastards. This had the hallmark of one of the largest shops, bond shops in the world, knowing something. The number of shops of even central banks that can take on this level of market risk is extremely small. Some that come to mind are hedge funds managers John Paulson, Bill Gross's PIMCO, and the U.S. and Chinese central banks. Now, Paulson already scored big, about $6 billion big, on a similar trade years ago when he bet against subprime mortgages, the investments that helped bring down Lehman Brothers and many other investors. Whoever was behind it wanted to trade on ASAP and didn't care about the ripples they would cause. You can see how the trade caused fear to be unleashed in the market once it got out and the implications hit by looking at the U.S. Treasuries. People who were long 30-year Treasuries panicked as they saw the huge short put on the futures market and started to unwind their long exposure. What you, as investors, should know now is look at the bond exchange traded funds or the ETFs that provide a positive rate of return when U.S. Treasuries drop in value. Yields are going up sooner rather than later, if the person behind this Armageddon trade is correct. We're in the midst of the greatest investing boom in about 60 years. And rest assured, this boom is not about to end anytime soon. You see, the flattening of the world continues to spawn new markets worth trillions of dollars, new customers that, this is more of an ad, I think, to this guy. But it's quite frightening, actually, that somebody would do that. You know, somebody would put $1 billion trade in, you know, a short and destroy the credibility of the market. Now, it says it's either the United States did it, could have been, all right, to make money, make $1 trillion. It's a good way to make $1 trillion, I guess. Federal Reserve would have done it. You know, they would have known what was going on. So, I don't know. This whole thing is a game, folks. And looks to me like we're losing. There we go. Here we go. I love this. Millionaires Nancy Pelosi calls for you to live an era of austerity. In a statement that is shocking many pundits, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi warned the country, "It is clear we must enter an era of austerity to reduce the deficit through shared sacrifice." She's worth over $25 million. Okay, she owns a vineyard in California, and this babe's austerity is like, come on. And this is from the Think Progress thing. It's clear, in a statement that is shocking many pundits, House Minority Leader warned the country, "It's clear we must enter an era of austerity to reduce the deficit." However, Pelosi denounced the plan put forward by Speaker John Boehner as a long-term plan that burdens the middle class and seniors and continues debate about whether we will default in a few months from now. Democrats have given up on their demands for a balanced plan with new revenue, but the two sides remain divided over their respective plan for deficit reduction, and both sides seem to be expecting the worst and preparing the country for the same. We're about to go over a cliff here, says Senator Harry Reid. So he... just amazes me. Totally amazes me. Corporate tax holiday and debt ceiling deal. Where's the uproar? There we go, folks. There we go. This probably is it. This explains everything. And again, where's the uproar? This is from Rolling Stone magazine. Corporate tax holiday and debt ceiling deal. Where's the uproar? This is from Matt Taibbi. I've been meaning to write about this, but I'm increasingly amazed at the overall lack of uproar about the possibility of government approving another corporate tax repatriation holiday. I've seen it. I've been in and out of D.C. a few times in the recent weeks, and one thing I keep hearing is that there is growing and real possibility that a second one-time tax holiday will be approved for corporations as part of whatever assorted deal emerges from the debt ceiling negotiations. I passed it off as a bad joke when I first heard the news of it a few weeks ago, when it was reported that Wall Street whipping boy Chuck Schumer was seriously considering the idea. Then I read later on that other senators were jumping on the bandwagon, including North Carolina Kay Hagan. This is what Hagan's spokesperson said. Senator Hagan is looking closely at any creative short-term measure that can get bipartisan support and put people back to work. One such potential initiative is a well-crafted and temporary change to the tax code that encourages American companies to bring money home and put it towards capital investment and, most importantly, American jobs. For those who don't know about it, tax repatriation is one of the all-time long cons and also one of the most supremely evil achievements of Washington lobbying community, which has perhaps told more shameless lies about this one topic than about any other in modern history, which is saying a lot, considering the many absurd things that are said and done by lobbyists in our nation's capital. Here's how it works. The tax laws say that companies can avoid paying taxes as long as they keep their profits overseas. Whenever that money comes back to the U.S., the companies have to pay taxes on it. Think of it as a gigantic global IRA. That's amazing. Huh? Companies that put their profits in offshore IRA can leave them there indefinitely with no tax consequence. Then when they cash out, they pay the tax. Only there's a catch. In 2004, the corporate lobby got together and major employers like Cisco and Apple and GE begged Congress to give them a one-time tax holiday, arguing that they would use the savings to create jobs. Congress shamefully relented, and tax holiday was declared. Now companies paid about 5% in taxes instead of 35% to 40%. God. Money streamed back into America, but the companies did not use the savings to create jobs. Instead, they mostly just turned it into executive bonuses and ate the extra cash. Some of those companies promising waves of new hires have already committed to massive layoffs. It was bad enough that lobbyists managed to pull this trick off once in 2004, but in one of the worst-kept secrets in Washington, companies immediately started to systematically offshore their profits right after the 2004 holiday, with the expectation that somewhere down the road, and probably sooner rather than later, they would take another holiday. Now, this is such traitorous crap. This is the kind of stuff that's destroying our company, our country, destroying this country, to, you know, stealing from this country. These fucking corporations, you know, that are getting away with it, and these idiots, these traitors in our Congress that are allowing it, and our executives are allowing this to happen. I mean, this is just treason beyond everything, and it's allowed to happen. Allowing to happen. It's just it's beyond belief. Companies have been doing this for years to incredible effect. Bloomberg's Jesse Drucker estimates that Google, all by itself, has saved $3.1 billion in taxes in the past 3 years by shifting its profits overseas. Add that to the already rampant system of loopholes, and what you have is a completely broken corporate tax system. And that's why I refuse to use Google. I don't care. I never go onto Google for a search. And the whole thing is predicted on that dirty little secret. The notion, long known to all would-be major corporate taxpayers, that they would come a day when there would be another tax holiday. That time, they hope, is now, according to Drucker. Lobbyists met with President Obama last December to ask for another holiday. And now the drumbeats are rolling on the Hill for a new holiday to be included in the debt ceiling deal. Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, the same senator who produced the damning report of corruption on Wall Street, has been trying to fight the problem, introducing a measure that would prevent companies from accessing offshore money through correspondent accounts and branches of offshore banks. Levin's permanent subcommittee on investigations has also been investigating how companies might use the cash as they save from a tax holiday, surveying companies like DuPont, presumably to find out just how many of these firms really intend to create new jobs with their tax savings. I'm shocked there isn't more of an uproar about this. Could you imagine that the Tea Party would be saying right now if there was a law on the books that allowed immigrants to indefinitely avoid taxes on income sent back to family members in the old country, in Mexico, in Venezuela, in India? Imagine the uproar of Barack Obama in the middle of his historic revenue crunch, and we're so broke the world is going to end tomorrow, debt ceiling hysteria, decided to declare a second one-time tax holiday for, say, unwed single mothers or recipients of public assistance. Middle America would be running through the streets, firing shotguns at his truck windows, waving chainsaws and mall lobbies. As it is, leading members of the Senate are seriously considering giving the most profitable companies in the world a total tax holiday as a reward for their last 7 years of systematic tax avoidance. And hundreds of billions of potential tax dollars would disappear from the Treasury. And there isn't a peep from anyone anywhere on this issue. We're seriously talking about defaulting on our debt and cutting Medicare and Social Security so that Google can keep paying its current 2.4% effective tax rate. 2.4% tax rate. And GE, a company that received a $140 billion bailout en route to worldwide 2010 profits of $14 billion, can not only keep paying no tax at all, but receives a $3.2 billion tax credit from the federal government. And nobody appears to give a shit. And what the hell is wrong with people? Have we all lost our minds? And, yeah, man, that's what's happened. That's exactly what's happened. So, I don't know, folks. You know, tells you something, don't it? Tells you something. Really tells you what the hell's going on, guys. I don't know. I'm kind of disgusted. I'm just disgusted, you know, that these things can happen and are happening regularly. I'm going to give you a break from my reading, and I'm going to go to an essay here that, not an essay, but I can get it. Damn it. Hold on. just bear with me for 1 second here. We'll see if we can. I'm gonna go for. It's probably a good time to go for a quick little music break. And we're gonna do that. So hang on with me here, and we will be right back. I've got a quick, hopefully I can play this for you. About a 5-minute video or audio from Ron Paul. It's an urgent warning. And blood in the streets, he talks about blood, possible blood in the streets happening. But let me just preface this because, well, you can hear it. But I think it's worth listening to if we can pull it up tonight. My system doesn't. There you go.
But it can come quickly. Resorting to buying other paper currencies will not be of much help. When the dollar crashes, most likely the purchasing power of all currencies, since all currencies hold dollars as a reserve, will go down as well. This means that dollars and other currencies will go into buying consumer items, precious metals, and other physical properties. Consumer prices will soar, as well as interest rates. The central bank will lose control, and the more they inflate, the worse the confidence becomes. The interest rates will respond to these efforts by rising sharply. If the Fed tries to reverse the run on the dollar, interest rates will also soar, and the pain on the American citizens will be of such proportion that political chaos will result. Either scenario leads to political and social chaos, the third event, and the most dangerous. With no ability of the federal government to fund its commitments, international or domestic, major changes will occur in our system. The social unrest will elicit cries for government to exert unusual force to head off a complete breakdown of law and order. The ultimate trap will be set for a system of government claiming to protect a free society. If more power and police authority are not given to the federal government, it will be argued that only anarchy will result. If more government policing power is given, it will mean a lethal threat to civil liberties. Already, we have permitted the notion that a single person, the Attorney General or the President, can decide who is an enemy combatant, thus denying that individual the right of habeas corpus, permitting indefinite detentions without charges made. This attitude towards civil liberties has changed significantly since the fear built around 9/11. Yes, I know, declaring one an enemy combatant is reserved only for the radical Muslims engaged in terrorism against the United States. To be reassured by this reasoning is quite dangerous and naive. Logic should not lead us to equate suspects with terrorists and include American citizens, and yet this has already been set by precedent. Under difficult circumstances, our political leaders will not be hesitant to use these powers to maintain order. Tragically, the people may even demand it. We are rapidly moving toward a dangerous time in our history. Society as we know it is vulnerable to political and social unrest. This impending crisis comes as a consequence of our flawed foreign and domestic economic policies, a silly notion about money, ignorance about central banking, and ignoring the onerous power and mischief of out-of-control intelligence agencies. Our unsustainable welfare state and a willingness to sacrifice privacy and civil liberties in an attempt to achieve safety and security from an inept government. Dangerous times indeed. What can be done about it? Must we wait for the inevitable and expect to restore our liberties in a street fight against the overwhelming power of the state? Not a good option. The only way that we can prevent blood from running in the streets is to offer a better idea of the proper role of government in a society that desires first and foremost liberty. And that is impossible without a firm commitment by our thought leaders to the ideas of freedom. The source of all creative energy and prosperity, an all-powerful state is the threat to that ideal. The prevailing attitude of the people, as it once was in early America, must be that of liberty and self-reliance, rather than the nanny state and dependency. Rely on the government's force to mold all private choices. If this is understood, a smooth, although not painless, transition to a free society is achievable. Ignoring this option will be very destructive to everything that is dear to the hearts of most Americans. What is it that we must do? We must immediately embark on balance the budget by reducing spending, change our foreign policy so to that of non-intervention, a full audit and more supervision of the Federal Reserve, leading to abolishing the Federal Reserve, legalize competition to the Federal Reserve with competing currencies, regain respect for civil liberties and privacy while reining in the CIA, wean ourselves off the dependence of wealth transfers by government, abolish crony capitalism, no subsidies, no bailouts, no regulatory or tax privileges to protect the powerful elite, especially the military-industrial complex, eliminate the income tax, the inheritance tax, and taxes on savings and dividends. None of this can happen without the restoration of Congress to its dominant position of the three branches of government, as was originally intended by the Constitution. The executive and the judicial must be reined in, and Congress must assert its prerogatives over all legislation curtailing all unconstitutional agendas through budgetary controls. Signs abound that angry Americans are now more ready than ever before for a change in direction that is indeed real. If this program were improvised, even suddenly and dramatically, the adjustment, though significant and to a degree somewhat painful, would be much shorter and of minor consequence compared to the chaos and poverty that will result if we refuse to change our gluttonous appetite for a free lunch.
Now, I didn't want to say this, but you know, if this guy was an independent, not a Republican, he would have far more credibility. He doesn't mention anything about the idiots in his party, Republican Party. And, you know, sorry, Ron, blood from the poor is exactly what the Tea Party wants. And Ron Paul is a big Tea Party favorite. I mean, those are the guys behind him. Because that, you know, the guy just doesn't have any credibility as far as I'm concerned. He says the right things. He says great things. But listen, if you listen to what he said, he wants to cut all these social programs. This is what he's all about, you know. And you can't. You can't. And if people understand that Republicans want to destroy Medicare, they want to destroy Social Security, they want to destroy any form of welfare, and every form of welfare, you know, and, you know, kick out the disabled, not pay the veterans. These are the guys, these are the crooks, these are the bastards, these are the pricks that are ruining our country. All right? I'm not a Democrat. Democrats are just as bad. All right? But the one thing, the difference between a Democrat and a Republican, at least a Democrat knows he's got to throw throw something at the people. He's got to throw some money at the people, all right? If you want to get that, you know. Yeah, but the Republicans, they want to keep it all, man. The Republicans are pigs. They're gross pigs, okay? And they're perverts and they're crazies, all right? They want to take it all, you know, give it to the corporations, you know. And then the poor slobs. Now, this is another article I want to bring up tonight before I end, because to me, these people are just crazy. J.P. Morgan tells investors why middle-class Americans are screwed, all right? And he talks about the idiots who are supporting these corporations, who are the Tea Party, the working-class fool, okay? Republican, who has no clue what the hell is going on. How many working-class Republicans do you know? How many blindly vote against their own economic interests? It is not their fault. They have just been duped into believing the conservative mantra that the government is stealing their money, when in actuality it is the wealthy who are stealing their money. Let's take welfare, for example. According to the report in USA Today, in 2010, 4.4 million people were on welfare. In a country of 330 million people, that's equal to a little over 1% of the population. Many people do not know that statistic, because the corporate media wants to sensationalize news, and this statistic will not get the blood boiling. Now, there are also 50 million people on Medicaid. This is also welfare, just not the check poor people used to buy clothing, gas, and pay for their electric bills. The reason why there are so many people on Medicaid is simply because businesses are not providing health insurance to their employees, or if they are, the cost of the employee is too much because their checks are so small. when your Republican friends are not happy, and they have been told that if we reduce taxes on the job creators, those tax savings will trickle down to them in the form of better wages or benefits. Your Republican friends are getting squeezed financially, all the while the wealthiest of America are having their taxes cut and earning more. Each and every time the federal government reduces taxes on the wealthiest in this country, that translates to lower state aid from the federal government. The states increase sales taxes, then push the burden onto the local towns and cities by cutting local aid from the state capitals to help fund schools, build roads, etc. This then translates to reduced police, firemen, teachers, parks, and senior centers, and or higher property taxes on the small business owners and middle-class homeowners. In a recent report by J.P. Morgan, the memo to their investors from Michael Cimbellis, the chief investment officer, he says, U.S. labor compensation is now at a 50-year low relative to both company sales and U.S. GDP. Cimbellis continues to explain why corporate profits are so strong while the rest of the working class are feeling the pinch. Reductions in wages and benefits explain the majority of the net improvements in margins. 75% of the increase in profit margins directly correlate with a reduction in workers' wages. All right? I mean, you know, let's give these guys some more money? What the hell? Okay, why are your Republicans' friends aggravated? They aren't getting paid their fair share of the national GDP and economic growth, and they are paying an increased burden of the taxation in this country. Think about this. As you work harder for a company and productivity increases, you're not seeing your share of profits you helped the company earn. If you remember the report earlier this year that 50% of Americans do not pay taxes, all right? Well, that turns out to be first and foremost a cherry-picked piece of data. That is directly from 2009 when more people were unemployed. President Obama's tax cuts for working families, etc., in any other year, that number hovers around 35%. So, you know, and so the next time you have a discussion with a working class Republican, ask them when is the last time they heard their candidates ever mention American wages being on the decline. Then you tell them that it is the GOP that fights against raising the minimum wage and organized labor and ultimately fights against your economic interests. The Republican tells us that raising the minimum wage will cause an increase in price. Sure, this could happen unless you don't believe in competition in the free market. What happens if a company A doesn't pass on the extra wages onto the consumer, takes a smaller profit to keep prices low, while their competitors pass on the wage increase to keep profits high? The consumer will go to a company A and actually increase his profits due to increased consumer demand. All Republicans say is reduce taxes, as if that translated to increasing the economic status of working Americans. It hasn't, as J.P. Morgan has explained to us and to their investors. What middle-class workers need more than anything is an increased share of the economic growth. And the best way to rectify our middle class situation is to increase unions in the private sector. Unions in the past forced working class wages up for everyone and even for the non-union workers. The reason is competition. And non-union employers, would increase their own wages to compete with union shops in order to keep their employees happy and ultimately keep the union out. And so this anti-union, pro no tax and everything else is killing this country, and it's putting money and profit way, way, way ahead of the people. And with that, I'm going to end tonight. I want to thank everybody for listening. And please join me tomorrow night when I have a fascinating speech given by David Ray Griffin. Talking about something that I firmly believe is one of the biggest problems that this country faces, which is the nationalist faith. All right, and David Ray Griffin is a theologian, but he was also one of the original debunkers of the 911 official government theory. Okay, and this it's an hour long speech, but it's very good and very, very good. I listened to it the other day and I found it to be fascinating, and I decided I would put it on and play the entire speech on tomorrow night's show. So please join me then, and I thank you very, very much for joining me tonight, and I hope to talk to you. I hope you join me tomorrow night when we have that speech. So good night, everyone. Oh, and don't forget, Friday night this week, we have the return of Ross Hamilton, and we'll try to capsulize what we talked about in the last two or three programs that we did with him, and on the Serpent Mounds, and fascinating gentleman. Also, I meant to say, I guess for those of you interested, he is also appearing on the History Channel, I believe tonight. I believe it was at 8 o'clock, but if you, depending on where you are, if you're in California or some other place, you might be able to pick it up. That's the History Channel with Ross Hamilton, who will be our guest on Friday night. Okay, so